Hi guys, and welcome to today's podcast, where I'm joined by Mr. Tim Cameron Kitchen. I said this in your podcast, Tim, the first guy I know with a double barrel name. I don't know, it doesn't flow off very well when you're trying to.
It's a nightmare. No, I have to spell it out to people on the phone. I just say Tim CK, much easier.
Yeah, Tim CK is a lot easier, but. Welcome to the show, Tim. We've done Same Rush together. I appeared in your podcast recently, which I don't think's live yet. And now I've got the chance to pick your brains. But
Thursday.
Yeah.
Let's go. I'm ready, Craig. I'm ready.
But for the audience, the reason that I want to get Tim on, I am always talking about affiliate and why I hated agency life and the problems I had while trying to scale an agency. And Tim has done that successfully with 100 staff, and he doesn't have an office, so even better than I actually thought. So he's managing those staff from afar, which is not an easy task to do. But Tim, give us, before I go into picking your brain apart with all of this stuff, give us just for people who don't know who you are, what is your background? How long have you been in the industry, and when did this whole agency thing start?
Yeah, so I was actually a professional drummer, and I did that up until I think late 2010, maybe early 2013. It had always been my dream to be a drummer, so that's what I did. Like, I studied music at uni and came out of uni and I was like, right, I'm going to be in a band. So I lived on a farm with my band and we just recorded and ran out of money, basically. So in my spare time, what I did is set up a business doing online session drumming where I'd record for people over the internet. And a large part of what I did there to promote my business was build a website, get it ranked, running ads, that type of thing. Then in 2011, late 2011, probably early 2012, I built a website for my next door neighbor, who was a plasterer. It was the first website I'd ever built for a client, but I built it free because I got talking to him and he didn't have a website. And I got it ranked at the top of Google, and that completely changed his life. And it made me see that actually I could have way more impact building and ranking websites than I could with the drumming stuff. The drumming stuff had kind of lost its shine at that point. I wasn't really in love with it as much. So I decided to build more websites, and he told lots of people about his website, and I ended up doing loads of websites for tradesmen. Then wrote a book called How to Get to the Top of Google, which basically just shared the process I was using to rank these trade sites, which was, you know, this was the days of exact match domains when we could get a site ranked before it was even live in some cases. It was just ridiculous. So did loads of those, and then wrote the book, and the book started to take off, and I got more inquiries from the book than I could deal with. So I started hiring freelancers and putting processes in place, and over the next kind of year or so, that turned into Exposure Ninja, and then fast forward to today, there's 100 of us, and yeah, I've somehow ended up running an agency.
It's weird how it happens, though. You know, you just kind of blag your way in at the start, just give this a go, and before you know it, you find out that you quite enjoyed it and done something right. Before you know, it's similar to me. I was winging it, and then before I knew it, I had to hire a few guys, and then you're like, shit, like, I've got a real business here, and I have no clue what I'm doing. So it's a very familiar story. But what is also very familiar is obviously people start to get a bit of money, they start hiring people, and things go wrong in terms of hiring the wrong people, the processes are not in place, all of that kind of stuff. Now, obviously for you, to start that back then and get to 100 staff just now is a remarkable achievement. And I think for me, staffing the processes and building myself into the business were the massive downfalls where I was a control freak. I wanted everything to go through me. And that's not good. Looking back, delegation and all that's really important. So did you come across these kind of problems, or, you know, how did you get to 100 people? I mean, I got to 17 and I nearly died, like, trying to manage all of these people at some point. And it's crazy. So how did it seem so quick? What were you doing that I wasn't?
It's interesting you mentioned being a control freak. We had a similar sort of episode at a similar sort of size. So we got to probably, I think we were saying before, like 20, 25 people, and had a really tough time at that point. I made a video about this recently. As you go through the stages of growth, there's different times when it feels painful. And for me, the time when you've got like 15 or so people is the sweet spot of hell, because you don't have management structure in place to manage them. So you're having to directly manage them all. But yet there's so many people that you can't possibly have visibility on all the stuff that's going on. So I actually think that period is key. And if you can get through it with somehow, I don't know how we got through it, but if you can get through that period and you can start having some early stage managers and team leaders, then that really allows you to kind of move on. So I have the opposite experience, or the opposite challenge to being a control freak in the early days. I just, rather than delegated, I just abdicated. I found someone who was good. I'd give them my process and I'd say, go and run with it. And then I'd just leave them to it. And yeah, that meant that we ended up hiring a bunch of people that we shouldn't, because I wasn't having visibility on those decisions. It led to quality issues. It led to areas where we weren't as well developed, like sales, for example. We could market very well. We were getting a lot of leads, but we weren't closing many because I wasn't spending much time in sales. So it was kind of the process of growth has been constantly just fixing the next thing that's broken. And that doesn't really change today. But yeah, it's a very sticky point, that kind of 15 to 17 people. And I call it the sweet spot of hell, because for most people, it is really the most stressful time of running any business.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned there, that, you know, hiring the wrong people and the becoming lazy or just not understanding your processes is a massive thing. But how would you now, or how would your middle management or whatever you've got in place manage that? Because surely still hiring people, you know, you can't be that lucky and hire all the right people all the time. So what kind of tools or software or advice could you give to someone who maybe doesn't want to be the control freak like me? Because a lot of people are like you, but would rather just pay someone to get it done and hope that it gets done properly. So how do we mitigate that risk?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to find the sweet spot between control freak and absolute abdicator. So probably halfway between us is perfect. And I actually don't think anyone is built like that. You just kind of have to force yourself to go that way. So, for example, now in all of our roles that we, you know, all of the kind of worker roles that aren't a management role, everyone has 3 KPIs. These are the metrics that they have to work to, and this kind of tells us what good looks like in that role. So we have a way of measuring everyone's performance. We also use a piece of software called Hubstaff, which is quite a contentious thing, but it's basically an activity tracker, and it sits on the desktop and takes a screenshot every 5 minutes. And this is where the team clock in and out of work. So some people are a little bit I was seeing a post on LinkedIn this week saying something like, I don't track my staff. Like, you can work anytime you want, just let me know. And, you know, all of that type of stuff. And that's definitely cool as a concept. But over the years, we've actually found that this is pretty unsustainable as a scalable operation, because the reality is that, you know, even our managers, the manager of the CM, the content marketing team, has probably 30 people underneath him. He doesn't know what every single one of them is doing. And yes, they'll have team leaders, but he doesn't have like direct sight on everything that everyone is doing. So there needs to be a system in place where people that aren't performing, you know, you notice that stuff. So we'll have hub staff, and then we'll just do periodic spot checks to make sure that people are actually, you know, doing what they're supposed to do. We've got these KPIs, and then it's just about building, particularly when you're a remote business, building a structure where people that are struggling, because it's not always that people are rubbish. It sometimes is that there's a training need or there's a coaching need. It's when people are struggling that surfaces. So it's having spot checks, it's having QA processes, and it's basically building a system that monitors itself so that anyone who isn't performing, whether that's an attitude thing, a behavior thing, or a training thing, it's obvious to people further up the chain without us having to kind of sit down with them and go through every piece of work that they're doing, because obviously that's not sustainable. So that's the kind of long answer. It's about building a structure. So I think in the early days, it was very much around having very tight, clearly defined processes that we followed. And because I had built the processes myself, I knew what good looked like. So for example, if we were building a website, then we'd have a process which said, right, this person's doing the copy and putting them on this page, this person's doing keyword research, this person's doing the metas, this person's submitting to Google or whatever. And this whole thing would be built out in a very clear process. And then I'd just spot check every so often, just go and have a look at one of the sites that's been built and just go through, yep. Oh, looks like we've done the metas wrong, or there's something that needs to be fixed here. So I think it's about building a process. You're never going to see every little thing, but by having enough spot checks and finding that balance, you get a feel for what's wrong. And over the time, you do develop a kind of, our management team will say it now, like, I just get a feeling that this person's struggling, because you just, it's like feeding an AI, isn't it? You can spot patterns. You notice that someone's a bit slow on their replies on Slack, and you just kind of get to know what struggling looks like. So yeah, I think in the early days, it's about spot checks and rigid adherence to process. And then over time, it's about building that mindset into the management team and into the team leaders so that they can spot those behaviors.
So the next question, then, that's great advice, by the way. Check out Hubstaff guys, if you want to do these kind of checks. I think I don't need it anymore, but I wish I had knowledge of that. I've never even heard of it before, which is it's not a good thing. I really, you know, should know these things. But second thing I want to talk to you about is obviously hiring of staff. People always come to me. I've always found that I've hired young members of staff and trained them up. I think sometimes older people come in with a bit of an attitude and you know, some bad habits and stuff. So I've always found success with, you know, going after the younger people. You know, the guys that are sitting in front of me are in their mid-20s, and you know, I've trained them over a course of years to get them into the position they are. What does your staff, you know, where are you finding people? What angles are you getting at? Where do you find more staff? So obviously you've been 25 people and you need more content writers. Where are you looking? And I know you're outsourcing, well, not outsourcing, but, you know, using a lot of virtual assistants probably. You know, what countries are you looking at? Is there any tips? Because I know, like, common sense things like, say, for example, outsourcing your content to India when it's their second language is probably a big no-no in a lot of cases. Yeah. I'm sure there are very good Indian people, but, you know, I've heard people say South Africa is a great place to find writers. So just curious to know where you look for staff and what type of person you're looking for.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I guess it probably depends on the seniority of the role as well and what that person needs to do. So most of our staff are UK-based. We have a contingent in the Philippines, which tends to be support-based roles and some of the technical roles. We also have the developers, like the actual website developers, the coders. There's a mixture there between UK-based and India, Pakistan, that sort of area where they're often very strong with technical skills. So we're not averse to hiring overseas, absolutely. In particular, I think there's a very strong cultural match between the Philippines and the UK. So it's interesting on Slack, which is where we talk often, it's you don't necessarily, you kind of forget that you're talking to people that are actually halfway across the world. And some of our Filipino team, like our head of finance is Filipino, and I've been working with her since, you know, the really, really early days, probably since 2012 or something, which is crazy. It's coming up for a decade. So I think there's a misconception that when you're working with someone overseas, they're just a worker, like a worker unit. Whereas actually, you know, Rain is, we trust her with all the accounts, everything, you know, completely open. She's got access to everything. And, you know, she's like my mother, basically. Most of the people that we hire for like content roles or pay-per-click roles or social media, like the client service type stuff tends to be UK based, and we just tend to go through normal job ad sites like Indeed. As for seniority and how old people are, we've got a couple of grads. We've just started a grad scheme, but we've tended to hire people that have expertise in the area, and then we'll give them our process. I hear what you're saying about sometimes when you bring on someone who's got a lot of experience, they're kind of, well, we're going to do things my way. I think we interview for that. And part of the interview process is giving people demo tasks and getting them to follow processes and stuff. So we try to pick up on, are they going to be difficult to turn into a ninja? We try and pick up on that in the interview. So we'll have normally two different interview stages. The first one will be, now I'm probably going to get this wrong, but the first, anyway, I don't know which one's the first and which one's the second, but one of them is just like an introduction to the business and talking through their experience and, you know, the classic job interview stuff. And then another one will often be like a role play scenario or a demo task where we'll get them to do something and we'll give them different scenarios and just try and understand how they react. And these are designed very specifically to identify the sort of person that we know fits here. So we'll be looking at, you know, how do they react in this particular situation? And when they're under pressure, do they default to matching our core values or do they have their own set of values? Because we know that value match is very difficult to overcome. So yeah, it's stuff like that. And then of course, listening out for anyone that says I work smart or not hard, you know, it's little things like that where we know, right, you're not going to fit here.
That's it. I just like understanding other people's views on what they're looking for. I think staffing is a massive, massive issue. But what I do want to just re-emphasize is, you know, I use people that are not in the UK for specific things. As you say, you know, India, for example, technically gifted. Eastern Europe, very technically gifted. You know, Philippines, I've also had people there. So it is a great option to use people, not just in the UK. I think obviously having people in the UK potentially for content or other stuff is a great option. But yeah, I don't want to be seen as saying that there's not good people abroad for sure. And obviously you've found that to be the case with your finance person in the Philippines, which is amazing. I think, you know, there are some real golden people out there across the world. And I think it's a great thing to do for your business, just to have, you know, I started off my business, there was only local people that I would use. And I don't think that actually worked that well. It wasn't until I started seeing other people and seeing the values that they have and stuff, it was a great option. But you obviously mentioned your interview process and the role play and all that kind of stuff. I'm just curious to know, you know, just for people listening, if they are going for a job interview, obviously run-of-the-mill introduction to the business is a run-of-the-mill interview. But the second part where you are putting them in these positions and trying to find out more about them as a person, how long does an interview like that take? Is that a couple of hours or what does it look like?
I think each interview is probably about an hour. It depends. Sometimes for a more senior role, it might be longer and we might have a third interview. But each one's about an hour. And actually, just going back to what you said right at the start, where, you know, at the start of your career in digital marketing, you're kind of blagging your way through, and all of us do. On this topic of if you're going in for an interview, one of the things that we really get excited by are people that have their own projects and that have done stuff and they've run sites. And if, you know, if it's SEO, they've run and ranked sites. That type of stuff is really interesting because I don't think anything gives you a better experience. I get asked probably once a day, like, what's the best digital marketing course or like what qualifications are you looking for and stuff like that. And I don't know about you, Craig, but I haven't seen that many courses and accreditations which I'd give the time of day. And I know that maybe that's biased because I haven't been through them, but much more useful than that is someone who's running a blog on their own site and they've got affiliate income coming through or something like that, because we know that they've got the drive because running a business isn't easy. We know that they've got the chops because they've obviously done it, and we know that they've got, you know, the skills because this is what they're going to be doing for clients. So that's the sort of thing that really appeals as a hirer. It's not like, oh, we're going to be scared that you're going to go and run your own thing. Like, no, we love it when you're running your own thing, because it shows that you're into it and you're, you know, you're interested in this as a passion. So yeah, that's one thing I'd say to anyone who's going, who's interested in getting a job in digital marketing, is do some stuff. Like, if you're just getting new, go and build a website for free, get it ranked. Just find something that you're passionate about, build a content site and get it ranked. Because for an agency like us, that is a big tick.
I think I have similar values. I'm not that fussed on courses and stuff like that. It's just people that take action and at least try and do a bit. You know, that hunger and desire and passion that I'm looking for, and everything else can come from there. As you say, you've got your own processes and stuff anyway, so training can be given. But one other thing I want to touch on, obviously you said you're happy that people do their own thing. Do you never fear, as an agency owner, that you give the staff too much information and they do bugger off and do their own thing? Or is that something you encourage? Because obviously, if you're spending years developing someone and then they just bugger off to the next agency for, you know, an extra $500 a year, that can be painful. So how do you view that? And you know, then obviously leading on to that, how do you keep these staff? Because obviously staff retention is important, you know, buying into the way you guys work. So what sort of things are you doing to then keep those staff?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think when we first started, I was really scared of losing people. And, you know, someone starts a site in their spare time and you're like, oh, is this their get out? Like, are they plotting something? And we've had people that have like taken elements of exposure ninja. We had someone who basically took one of our website templates and set it up on the side and then started trying to drive traffic through it and set up their own agency, you know, basically just it's as close as you can get to our IP, if you like. So this stuff does happen, but I think as long as you're pushing ahead and as long as the agency is sufficiently ambitious and growing, that actually builds a momentum where people want to work their way up in the agency rather than work their way out. So even if you lose someone who's relatively senior, like, we've got no management turnover whatsoever. I don't think we've ever lost a manager that we didn't want to. But if we did, and the worst came to the worst and we did, we know that we'd have like five candidates internally for that role, and people are just desperate to move up to the next stage. So actually we have the kind of opposite problem where we have such low turnover that it creates this kind of pressure in the next level that kind of wants to move up. So I guess that also ties into the retention question and how do you retain people? I think it's, I don't know, because I've never had a job, so I don't know what the outside world looks like, but people say things like it's a very caring environment. And, you know, when someone has a loss in the family, you know, we'll send them flowers and we'll just handle all their work for them and just say, just go and take as much time as you need and that type of thing. We have like internal days where we'll do things together or little events and quizzes and stuff like that. So we try and build a bit of a team thing. And then I just think it's about, you know, we're really ambitious, we're really aggressive, we're obsessed with improvement. And I think that's quite an energizing environment for people to be in. I think if you want to develop as a person, being in an environment like that, where we're constantly looking for new opportunities to give you responsibility, we're constantly pushing you to be the best version, is actually quite a fun place to be, I hope. I don't know. You'll have to ask them. But that's my take on it from, you know, what people say.
So out with all, obviously you've got your staff, you've got your stuff delegated out, blah, 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 blah. What does your day-to-day running of an agency look like now? For me, again, I massively built myself into the business, which was all wrong. I should have been working on the business rather than inside it. What position are you in now? You know, what are you actually doing day to day as an agency owner?
It's a good question. And when I was growing the business, and you know, you'd listen to a CEO say, well, my job is like to embed the vision in the company, I'd be like, well, that sound like a job. Like, what's that? That's a 15-minute thing every 2 weeks. Like, what are they doing? Playing golf. Since in October 2019, I gave away the final piece of direct management I had, which was managing our sales team. So I moved into a CEO role, and I always had a bit of a weird relationship with the CEO title, because I felt like it's mostly used by people on LinkedIn who are like founder and CEO of a one-person company. And I just either felt like someone who was trying to seem bigger than they were, or it felt like, you know, in order for me to take the CEO role, I'm basically pushing everyone else down and saying, right, I'm the top, I'm the king of this. And that always didn't sit well with me, because I'm quite aware of my flaws and the areas that I'm not as developed as some of our management team. But then I realized that actually the company needs a direction. The company needs strategy. We need to be looking at what services we can add. We need to be constantly talking to our clients and making sure that we're giving them something that they actually want. We need to be talking to the team and finding out, are they happy? Like, what can we do to improve things internally? So that tends to be my focus now, is this kind of big fluffy vision piece, which is basically setting a goal for a company and making sure everyone's aware of that goal. And then it's just going around and making sure everything's okay and that nothing's on fire. So that's really it. And another thing I'm looking at is acquisitions and what we need to do to grow. So developing new services or buying in those services. So a typical day might be check-ins with people. There might be a component of strategy. I'm still kind of the face of the business, in the sense that I'm in the videos and I do the podcast myself. So that takes probably the equivalent of a day or 2 days a week. And then the rest of the time is fixing internal processes, working on feedback. We're obsessed with feedback. So anytime we have a client pause or downgrade, we go really in depth to like, what could we have done better? What are the processes that need optimizing and stuff like that? So that takes a huge amount of time. It's immensely draining. Not just for me, but the whole team. So I'll get quite heavily involved with that and designing new processes. I've been designing a process recently for customer research. So for our clients, understanding their customers, and I'll do a few of those calls to just work on the process so I can then give it to the teams to implement and embed. So yeah, coming up with ideas, checking that nothing's on fire, and making sure everyone's aligned with the vision. I guess those are the big things that I work on.
I think that would have been roughly the answer I would have been expecting if you were doing it properly. I think a lot of people tend to make out like they're still, you know, hands-on and all that stuff, which you don't build a business to be, you know, in and about, you know, managing the teams and stuff like that. So I think you've obviously done a great job in the period of time that you've grown to that size. But another thing that I do want to ask you is, you mentioned that you like to look at acquisitions and stuff like that, and you mentioned off air that you potentially are looking to buy up smaller agencies and things like that. You know, what obviously that's a great thing to do, you know, buying up another agency, but how does that look for you? So you buy up, I don't know, just say there's an agency up the road, 10 staff, mm-hmm. 40 clients, blah, 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 blah. You pay, I don't know, £1 million for it. What do you do from that point? Get rid of all the garbage clients, steal some of the staff? What are you actually acquiring when you're buying that?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think for us to, so we had this conversation probably a year ago internally when we noticed that, you know, things were locking down and all of this, and all of a sudden there was a huge amount of very cheap capital available through CBILS loans and stuff like that. So immediately my head went straight to, everyone else is shutting down, let's buy, this is a great time. So in that situation, we started looking particularly at Shopify Plus agencies, because Shopify Plus is a very limited service. There aren't many Shopify Plus agencies, very difficult to become a Plus partner. And we knew that a lot of these agencies weren't selling kind of ongoing marketing to their clients, which is, you know, that this is the majority of our revenue. So in that sort of situation, we'd be buying the team, the processes, their client acquisition process, and we'd be bolting on our marketing sales on the back end of that to make them more profitable. But also, you know, we could then offer Shopify Plus to our clients. So that's the main thing that we're looking at. We're looking at someone who has something which is complementary to us rather than just a smaller, younger version of us. Having said that, if there's an agency that's, for example, getting clients through a different way, like we're not, like maybe they're going into pitch meetings. We don't do any pitch meetings. We don't do any RFPs. If we found an agency that was doing a really good job of getting business through that way, then that would be really interesting to us because we're buying expertise in a particular way, which could help us unlock growth for them and us. Same thing if we found an agency that was really strong in a particular area, which we're maybe not so focused. We looked at an affiliate agency last year for this purpose, where they're really good at selling affiliate programs, which isn't something that's on our roster at all. But building affiliate programs, but you know, they didn't have any SEO, CM, pay-per-click, none of this stuff, which is obviously stuff that we add in. So we're not necessarily looking for just kind of a smaller version of ourselves. We're looking for someone that has something, whether it's a service or a process, which will help us both grow, really.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And when these guys say they've got a domain name and everything else, you just continue to run that website as if that is the company and just upsell basically the better bunch of services that you've all got combined?
Yeah, it would depend. If we looked at some agencies where their website's terrible, they don't really have any brand name, and what they've got is something like Shopify Plus partner status, in which case there's actually no value in their brand name. They get very little traffic to their website. All of that stuff is worthless. So what we probably do is fold that into Exposure Ninja because we've got more of a brand name than they would have. Having said that, if it's a business that's established and it's got its own brand and it's very, self-sustaining and all of that, then it would make no sense for us to kind of get rid of that stuff because that's what we're buying. So I think it depends on what the agency had. But if they've got an established, established site with ranking, then of course we're not gonna abort that. We're gonna keep that and run the two brands side by side, but sharing back office function and sharing processes.
I'm just curious to know
how
you guys do it. I've never bought up another agency before, but yeah, I'm just curious to know the benefits, which I'm sure a lot of people believe that makes perfect sense. Now, just going back a little bit, and this will be the last part, and then I will let you crack on with the rest of your day because I know it is Friday. You mentioned that 2 days a week you're doing this whole podcast thing and being the face of the company and all of that stuff. How important do you think it is for you to be that face of a company? So just for other agencies out there, a question I'm asked a lot because I've built a personal brand round about this lovely face here. And people say, should you be a personal brand? Should you become an agency name? You're probably doing a mixture of both. I've went the personal branding route, and obviously there's benefits and there's also downsides to doing a personal brand. What would be your advice? I know you're in the position you're in just now, but for someone starting out, what would you say is the best option?
I actually think it depends on the person because you have charisma, you are very personable, people really get into following you, and I think if you are that mold, then it absolutely makes sense to use what you've got. Some of our competitor agencies, when you watch a video from the founders or whatever, it's the driest, most boring thing in the world, and you go on their YouTube channel and they've got like 12 views from a video that they made 3 years ago, and it's because the person that to build a personal brand around that just isn't viable. That person has strengths in other areas. So if you're really technical, you don't feel comfortable doing podcasts and doing videos, that's completely okay. Loads of successful agencies run by operators that are behind the scenes and very focused, and they don't rely on a personal brand. However, if you are the sort of person that's happy to just jump on a podcast or make a video and talk for an hour about something that you're passionate about, or whether you know about it or not, then use that to your advantage. I think it's all about sell what you've got. So for us, I've always been the face of the business, and we hear from clients that they follow our videos, they watch loads of them. We've had clients that have watched our videos for like 5, 6, 7 years, and then they become a client, all that time later. So I think if you're going to do it, as you'll know, when you start, you're doing it to almost no one. The audience is almost nothing. So you have to believe in it. You have to be comfortable to continue doing it as you build up an audience and as you build up visibility. Otherwise, you'll just quit. But equally, if that's not you, that's completely fine. You don't need a personal brand to be at the front of the agency. Your sales staff, they're going to be the, you know, they're all singing or dancing people that are going to be in front of clients. So that's okay. I think it depends. My preference would always be to have some kind of personal figure in the business. Yes, it makes you less valuable if someone was to acquire, because if someone wanted to buy EN, for example, they would lose the Tim character. And they might attach some value to that given that it's mentioned by clients. But at the same time, what I don't want to do is build it purely around me, because then when a client comes on, they think, well, you know, where's Tim? Why isn't Tim doing my SEO? Well, I haven't done SEO since 2013. You don't want me doing your SEO. You want dedicated SEO. So I think it's about balancing that. And that's why we choose, you know, it's Exposure Ninja. It's not all about Tim, but Tim is the kind of face of it at the moment. We are testing kind of bringing more ninjas on and bringing more ninjas to join the live videos with me and stuff like that. And what we found is that particularly client facing people are much, you know, very often very much more confident because they're used to being on calls and video calls. So they're much more engaging. Whereas some of the technical team, they don't thrive in that situation. It's uncomfortable for them. And this isn't everyone, but, you know, on the whole, you might see that split. So kind of forcing them to be the face of the business is going to be difficult for everyone involved. You've got to look inside yourself and think, you know, do I feel comfortable doing this? If you're doing it purely for fame, then I think it's the wrong thing. As long as you're doing it to build the business, then I think it can really work out. And you know, you've shown it. You've got killer YouTube following, and people really kind of follow you and kind of worship the Craig Campbell way, which I think is great. And that is the basis of growing a really successful business with a personal brand as the figurehead, I think.
Yeah, it's obviously got its downsides as well. As you say, people always want me. And obviously, it's not just me that's here. You know, I do have a team. And it's always like, where's Craig? I want Craig on the call. I want this. I want that. And, you know, your inbox gets flooded. Craig, help me, help me, help me, help me. And you're just like, fuck. So it does have massive downsides. And sometimes I sit at night and my head's just fried and I just go on the PlayStation, just like, please don't talk to me, anyone. It can be overwhelming. So it does not always, listen, I love it. I've been able to build a brand, but it's not all it's cracked up to be as well. You do get a lot of stick personally, and a lot of hassle. So be careful which way you do it. Again, you sat somewhere in the middle, which is probably what I would suggest to people. Trying to, the key thing you said there, Tim, is, you know, you're saying you don't do the SEO. You have done it since 2013, and I think that's important for people to know that, like, whether it's me or whether it's you, we've got businesses to run, and the chances of us doing all the grunt work is just, it's slim to none. We can't do it. And I think people need to understand that as well. When you're building a personal brand, people assume that is the case, that you're doing everything and you'll be on every call and you'll appear at every training course or whatever. And that's just not physically possible. But so just bear that in mind if you are going to be building a personal brand or whatever you do, take it into consideration. But Tim, it has been a pleasure to grab some of those insights off of you. Where is the best place for people to find more of you? I know you've got your Exposure Ninja website, which is exposureninja.com, where you've got your podcast, blog, case studies, training, services, and all that kind of stuff. Is there anywhere else you prefer people to contact you?
Yeah, if people are interested in me personally, I have a kind of personal YouTube channel, Tim Cameron Kitchen, and I'm on LinkedIn, Tim Cameron Kitchen Sharing. They make me post every day, so I'm posting something of varying quality on LinkedIn every single day while they're forcing me to do this. So Tim Cameron Kitchen, you can find me anywhere, and I'm happy to answer any questions and bounce ideas off wherever you find me, really. Actually, not Facebook. Don't message me on Facebook. No, can't be dealing with that.
It's hassle. But all the links will be below when this podcast goes out. So you'll be able to catch Tim on his LinkedIn, his YouTube channel, and obviously check out exposureninja.com. But thank you very much for taking the time to come on and share those insights, Tim. And hopefully, you get you the stuff you want to acquire and continue to grow, because it's great to see someone killing it. It's class, and it's been a pleasure having you.
Thanks, Craig. Absolute honour. Been a big fan of your work for many years. So, much respect.
Cheers.